Tensions continued to build on Thursday, with no resolution appearing any closer at hand. On the 23rd, U Thant, Secretary General of the United Nations, had proposed a pause in the crisis to Kennedy and Khrushchev. He suggested the Soviets stop shipping offensive weapons to Cuba for 2 or 3 weeks, and in exchange, the Americans would suspend the quarantine for the same length of time. October 25th. On the 25th, Kennedy politely turned down the offer because it would have allowed the Soviets to continue preparing the missiles that were already in Cuba. Kennedy raised military readiness to DEFCON 2. Early in the morning, Khrushchev received another correspondence from Kennedy, which restated the United States' position. Kennedy was not going to back down. Still attempting to avoid war, Kennedy had U.S. Ambassador Adlai Stevenson confront the Soviets at the United Nations. When asked directly about the missiles, Soviet Ambassador Zorin refused to comment. Consequently, Stevenson showed the reconnaissance photos of missile sites. Their effect was stunning. The photographs were unmistakable evidence of the Soviet presence in Cuba. A syndicated column written by influential journalist Walter Lippmann was also printed on Thursday. Lippmann suggested a face-saving missile exchange. The Soviets would remove their missiles from Cuba, and the Americans would remove their missiles from Turkey. Days before, XCOM had already begun to consider this option and was currently exploring the political consequences. Some government officials, both in the U.S. and Soviet Union, mistakenly interpreted Lippmann's article as a trial balloon floated by the Kennedy administration. It was not. In the Atlantic, tensions were also running high. The Soviet tanker Bucharest approached the quarantine line and was let through because there was no reason to believe it carried contraband cargo. To close the day, the aircraft carrier USS Kennedy neared the Lebanese freighter Markula, which President Kennedy had chosen to be the first ship boarded by quarantine forces. The USS Kennedy radioed the Markula that night to state it would be boarded the following morning. At the close of the 5 p.m. XCOM meeting, CIA Director McCone indicated that some of the missiles deployed in Cuba were now fully operational. In the early morning, U.S. quarantine forces boarded the Markula. After finding only paper products, they cleared the ship to Cuba. During the 10 a.m. XCOM meeting, Kennedy said that he believed the quarantine alone could not force the Soviet government to remove its offensive weapons from Cuba. A CIA report from that morning stated that there was no halt in progress in the development of the missile sites, and another reconnaissance flight revealed the Soviets were also attempting to camouflage the missiles. Kennedy believed that only an invasion or a trade for missiles in Turkey would now succeed. He also agreed to enhance pressure by increasing the frequency of low-level flights over Cuba from twice per day to once every 2 hours. October 26th. At lunchtime on the 26th, Alexander Fomin, who was known to be the KGB station chief in Washington, requested a meeting with ABC News correspondent John Scully. At the Occidental restaurant in Washington, Fomin hinted that there might be a resolution. Fomin proposed the dismantling of Soviet bases under UN supervision in exchange for a public pledge from the U.S. not to invade Cuba. After lunch, Scully went directly to the State Department to inform Roger Hilsman of the meeting. Since Fomin was a high-ranking officer, the U.S. assumed the proposal was an official one from Khrushchev. Later accounts from the Soviet side, however, suggest that Fomin's proposal was not, in fact, authorized by Moscow. Later in the day, Scully was sent back to Fomin with a message from Secretary of State Dean Rusk. "I have reason to believe that the U.S. government sees real possibilities and supposes that the representatives of the two governments in New York could work this matter out with U Thant and with each other. My impression is, however, that time is very urgent." Fomin assured Scully that he would convey the message to the highest Soviet sources. The most important occurrence on the 26th was not Fomin's message to Scali, but a letter from Khrushchev to Kennedy. The letter began to arrive at the White House at 6 p.m., but because it had to be translated, it came in four separate parts, the last of which arrived at 9 p.m. The letter was clearly an impassioned appeal written by Khrushchev himself to resolve the crisis. Khrushchev proposed removing his missiles if Kennedy would publicly announce never to invade Cuba. "You and I should not now pull on the ends of the rope in which you have tied a knot of war, because the harder you and I pull, the tighter the knot will become. And a time may come when this knot is tied so tight that the person who tied it is no longer capable of untying it, and then the knot will have to be cut. What that would mean, I need not explain to you, because you yourself understand perfectly what dread forces our two countries possess. I propose we, for our part, will declare that our ships bound for Cuba are not carrying any armaments. You will declare that the United States will not invade Cuba with its troops and will not support any other forces which might intend to invade Cuba. Then the necessity of the presence of our military specialists in Cuba will disappear." Later that night, unknown to XCOM, Robert Kennedy again went to the Soviet embassy to meet with Ambassador Dobrynin. When Dobrynin claimed Soviet missiles in Cuba were justified because of American missiles in Turkey, Kennedy offered to introduce the Turkish missiles into a potential settlement. Then the Attorney General reportedly left the room to call his brother. When he returned, he reported this to Dobrynin. "The President said that we are ready to examine favorably the question of Turkey." After the meeting, Dobrynin again cabled the Kremlin. October 27th. Saturday was the worst day of the crisis. One U-2 was shot down. Another flew off course over Russia. A low-level reconnaissance mission was shot at over Cuba, and a second, more demanding letter was received from Khrushchev. First, a U-2, on a routine air sampling mission over western Alaska, picked the wrong star to navigate by and flew off course into Soviet airspace. When he realized his mistake, the pilot immediately radioed for help. The operator was able to give him directions to turn his plane onto the right course. By that time, however, the Soviets had detected the U-2 and scrambled MiG fighters to intercept the spy plane. The Americans also scrambled their F-102 fighters to provide cover for the U-2. The F-102s, prepared for action, had been armed with nuclear-tipped air-to-air missiles. Fortunately, the U-2 left Soviet airspace in time, and two fighter groups never met. Upon hearing the news at the White House, Secretary of Defense McNamara turned absolutely white and yelled hysterically, "This means war with the Soviet Union." The Soviets, he feared, could have interpreted the flight as a reconnaissance mission before a nuclear strike. President Kennedy's reaction was much more calm and controlled. He laughed slightly and remarked, "There is always some son of a who doesn't get the word." Next, around noon, news reached XCOM that a U-2 had been shot down over Cuba. Major Randolph Anderson's spy plane was hit by a surface-to-air missile and crashed in the island's eastern jungle. XCOM interpreted the action as a planned escalation of the situation by the Kremlin. The order to launch the missile, however, did not come from Moscow. Rather, it was a Soviet commander in Cuba who gave the command. Khrushchev now worried that he had lost control of his forces. XCOM had previously decided that if an American reconnaissance plane was downed, the Air Force would retaliate by bombing the offending site. Now that it had happened, the Joint Chiefs, who had been pressing for permission to bomb Cuba, pressed even harder. Secretary McNamara laid out the situation plain and simple in these words: "We must be in a position to attack quickly. We've been fired on today. We're going to send surveillance aircraft in tomorrow. Those are going to be fired on without question. You can't do this very long. You're going to lose airplanes, and we'll be shooting up Cuba quite a bit. We must be prepared to attack Cuba quickly." General Taylor insisted that no later than Monday morning, the 29th, the U.S. should strike Cuba. Kennedy chose not to attack, but to wait for another plane to be shot down. Then he would order the destruction of the SAM site. Years later, McGeorge Bundy cited the two U-2 instances as reminders that crisis managers don't always manage everything. The next event in that long day was a low-level reconnaissance mission flown by six F-8U-1P Crusader jets. Two of the jets aborted the mission early due to mechanical problems, but the remaining four continued on their course. As the fighters passed over the San Cristobal and Sagua La Grande missile sites, Cuban ground forces shot at the planes with anti-aircraft guns and small arms. One plane was hit by a 37-millimeter shell, but fortunately it returned safely. Earlier in the morning, Castro had lost his nerve and ordered his troops to fire at the American aircraft. With each new flight, the Americans were gaining valuable information for an invasion Castro believed to be only 24 to 72 hours away. At 11:03 a.m., a second letter from Khrushchev arrived over a White House ticker. This letter, formally written, was much more demanding. Some members of XCOM speculated that hardliners had pressured Khrushchev to take a more aggressive position. The letter was also publicly broadcast in order to reduce communication delays, but the broadcast also raised the stakes. The two countries no longer had the luxury of private negotiations. Khrushchev wrote, "You are disturbed over Cuba. You say this disturbs you because it is 90 miles by sea from the coast of the United States of America. But you have placed destructive missile weapons, which you call offensive, in Turkey, literally next to us. I therefore make this proposal. We are willing to remove from Cuba the means which you regard as offensive. Your representatives will make a declaration to the effect that the United States will remove its analogous means from Turkey. After that, persons entrusted by the United Nations Security Council could inspect on the spot the fulfillment of the pledges made." This letter sent XCOM reeling. Khrushchev's previous proposal had not mentioned Turkey. Why did it do so now? Unknown to the entire committee was Robert Kennedy's discussion with Ambassador Dobrynin the night before. Neither of the Kennedys had informed the committee about the meeting because of one reason: leaks. Too much information on the crisis had already been leaked to the press. Kennedy feared having someone go public with the Turkey proposal because it could potentially ruin his career. If the U.S. buckled under pressure and removed its missiles from Turkey, a NATO ally, the whole alliance could falter. A political enemy would have a field day holding Kennedy responsible for the Turkey proposal. One can sense the president's caution in suggesting the idea of a Turkey for Cuba missile trade in this transcript of an XCOM meeting. Here's how the transcript goes. JFK speaks. "He, Khrushchev, has got us in a pretty good spot here, because most people will regard this, the new letter, as not an unreasonable proposal. I'll just tell you that. In fact, in many ways..." And then McGeorge Bundy interrupts. "But what most people, Mr. President?" JFK responds. "I think you're going to find it very difficult to explain why we are going to take hostile military action in Cuba against these sites. What we've been thinking about, the thing that he's saying is, if you'll get yours out of Turkey, we'll get ours out of Cuba. We can't very well invade Cuba with all its toll when we would have gotten the missiles out by making a deal on the same missiles in Turkey. If that's part of the record, I don't see how we'll have a very good war." Kennedy was frustrated, even more by the fact that he had wanted to remove the old, unreliable Jupiter missiles months before the crisis. Furthermore, Cuban missiles were not on par with Turkish missiles. The strategic value of the missiles in Cuba was immensely larger than the strategic value of the missiles in Turkey. Now Khrushchev wanted to make a public display of having the Jupiters removed. The president was stuck. Dreading conflict, he couldn't demand more of Khrushchev. Fearing political pressure at home, he couldn't give in on the question of Jupiter missiles in Turkey. Then Robert Kennedy had an inspiration. Why not ignore the second letter and respond only to the first? A long shot, but it might work, suggested Soviet specialist Llewellyn Thompson. To Kennedy, it seemed the only viable option left. Consequently, the president had Robert Kennedy and Theodore Sorensen draft a response. In 45 minutes, they returned to the meeting. The committee then edited the proposal and approved it. After the meeting adjourned, Kennedy called six men into the Oval Office. McNamara, Robert Kennedy, Bundy, Dean Rusk, Thompson, and Sorensen for further consultation. The president informed them of the Attorney General's meeting with Ambassador Dobrynin on the previous evening and asked for more suggestions on how to use this precious channel of communication. The group agreed to have the Attorney General meet with Dobrynin again to orally reinforce the proposal. Secretary Rusk also suggested that Robert Kennedy propose a secret deal on the Jupiter missiles in Turkey. At 7:45 that evening, Dobrynin came to the Justice Department to meet with the Attorney General. Robert Kennedy handed him a copy of the reply to Khrushchev's letter and then informed him of the secret deal. He gave assurances that the U.S. would quietly remove the Jupiters a few months after the crisis, but warned they could not be part of a public deal. Robert Kennedy also imposed an ultimatum to Dobrynin. If you do not remove those bases, we would remove them. He concluded by saying a Soviet commitment was needed by tomorrow. Immediately after the meeting, Dobrynin cabled Khrushchev to tell him of the proposal and that the Attorney General had imposed a deadline for a response. The Soviets just didn't know what that deadline was. Meanwhile, at the request of Secretary Rusk, John Scali met once again with Alexander Fomin. Rusk wanted Scali to find out why Khrushchev had suddenly introduced the Jupiter missiles into the deal. When Scali met Fomin in an empty ballroom at the Statler Hotel, he exploded. Why, Scali demanded, had Khrushchev performed a flip-flop? In response, Fomin muttered something about poor communications. Scali, not satisfied with the answer, accused Khrushchev of performing a stinking double-cross. The ABC News correspondent, in the heat of the moment, then gave a warning he had no right in making. American invasion of Cuba is only hours away, said Scali. Fomin was deeply impressed by the statement. After the two parted ways, he hurried back to the Soviet embassy to report the latest news to Khrushchev, while Scali wrote a memorandum summing up the encounter for XCOM. At 8:05 p.m., Kennedy released his response to Khrushchev's latest proposal. It was given to the press to avoid any communications delays. As I read your letter, the key elements of your proposals, which seem generally acceptable as I understand them, are as follows. You would agree to remove these weapon systems from Cuba under appropriate United Nations observation and supervision, and undertake, with suitable safeguards, to halt the further introduction of such weapon systems into Cuba. We, on our part, would agree upon the establishment of adequate arrangements through the United Nations to ensure the carrying out and continuation of these commitments, A, to remove promptly the quarantine measures now in effect, and B, to give assurances against the invasion of Cuba. In case Khrushchev did not accept the terms of the agreement, Kennedy and Rusk drew up a contingency plan for publicly announcing a Turkey for Cuba missile trade. Late in the evening, the two secretly contacted Andrew Cordier, a former UN undersecretary and friend of Rusk in New York. Rusk dictated a statement to Cordier that called for an open missile trade. If he received the correct signal from Washington, Courtier was supposed to deliver the statement to Secretary General U Thant, who would in turn make it public. McGeorge Bundy later likened the evening of the 27th to a tight chess match. The U.S. had made its move, he said. It was now up to Khrushchev to make his. Until then, the U.S. could only hope and wait. We had not abandoned hope, Robert Kennedy said. But what hope there was now rested with Khrushchev. It was a hope, not an expectation. The expectation was a military confrontation by Tuesday, October 30th, and possibly tomorrow. Early in the morning, Khrushchev met with a circle of his advisers outside of Moscow. During the night, he had received statements from both Dobrynin and Fomin, so he was aware how serious the crisis had become. October 28th. At the opening of Khrushchev's meeting, it got worse. A general entered and read a statement he had just received that Kennedy was going to make an address to the nation at 5 p.m. At that point, Khrushchev feared the worst. That address could be the announcement that an invasion was already underway. Khrushchev was not prepared to start a war. Therefore, he and his advisers drafted a letter with the utmost urgency. Upon completion, the letter was rushed at full speed to the broadcasting station. Khrushchev hoped the message would reach Kennedy before 5 p.m. "Esteemed Mr. President," it read, "I have received your message of October 27, 1962. I express my satisfaction and gratitude for the sense of proportion and understanding of the responsibility borne by you at present for the preservation of peace throughout the world. In order to complete, with greater speed, the liquidation of the conflict, the Soviet government, in addition to previously issued instructions on the cessation of further work at building sites for the weapons, has issued a new order on the dismantling of the weapons, which you describe as offensive, and their crating." The message received at 9 a.m. Eastern Time effectively ended the crisis. The reaction among the ex-com members was mixed. Most were relieved, but others, especially the Joint Chiefs, dubbed the announcement a ploy by Khrushchev to buy more time. General Curtis LeMay suggested that the United States go in and make a strike on Monday anyway. Kennedy, on the other hand, knew the response was genuine. Almost immediately, he drafted a response, which was broadcast over the Voice of America. President Kennedy stated, "I welcome Chairman Khrushchev's statesmanlike decision to stop building bases in Cuba, dismantling offensive weapons, and returning them to the Soviet Union. I think that you and I, with our heavy responsibilities for the maintenance of peace, were aware that developments were approaching a point where events could have become unmanageable. So I welcome this message and consider it an important contribution to peace." At 11 a.m., Ambassador Dobrynin arrived at the Justice Department to extend Khrushchev's best wishes to the Attorney General and the President. Ex-com ordered a halt to all reconnaissance flights on the 28th. The great crisis had been diverted, with Khrushchev announcing that he would dismantle the installations and return the missiles to the Soviet Union, expressing his trust that the United States would not invade Cuba. Further negotiations were held to implement the October 28 agreement, including a United States demand that Soviet light bombers be removed from Cuba, and specifying the exact form and conditions of United States assurances not to invade Cuba. In the afternoon, Dean Rusk held a press conference and cautioned against gloating over the Soviet decision. He said, "If there is a debate, a rivalry, a contest going on in the Kremlin over how to play this situation," Rusk warned, "we don't want to strengthen the hands of those in Moscow who wanted to play this another way." The Secretary of State also pointed out that because of inspection issues and the IL-28 bomber question, the crisis was still not completely settled. In Cuba, Castro was furious. Khrushchev had not had time to inform his ally of the decision, so Castro learned about the agreement over the radio. Hours later, and still immensely angry, Castro countered the agreement by saying a true solution would have included 5 more points. 1, an end to the economic blockade against Cuba. 2, an end to all subversive activities carried out from the United States against Cuba. 3, a halt to all attacks on Cuba carried out from the U.S. military bases on the island of Puerto Rico. 4, the cessation of aerial and naval reconnaissance flights in Cuba airspace and waters. 5, and the return of Guantanamo Naval Base to Cuba. Some members of the Kremlin were also unhappy, and Khrushchev questioned them. "You accuse me of pulling out our missiles? What do you mean, that we should have started a war over them?" Premier Khrushchev asked the Soviet Presidium. The two superpowers still had reached an agreement. During the course of the final negotiations, Castro, who felt betrayed by Khrushchev, tried to halt the removal and inspection of the missiles. Eventually, with the help of the UN, Castro backed down, and the two sides reached an agreement. A UN inspection team was assigned to monitor the removal of the missiles and the demolition of the missile bases in Cuba. The Soviet Navy shipped the missiles back to the USSR on the decks of the ships so that American reconnaissance planes could count the missiles and make sure that all had been removed. One stumbling block of the agreement was the removal of IL-28 Beagle medium-range bombers. Aware of the larger problem at hand, XCOM had decided to let this minor issue slide during previous negotiations. In Khrushchev's letter of the 28th, however, he stated the Soviets would remove all weapons which you describe as offensive. 20th. With that statement, the U.S. was able to successfully argue for the removal of the bombers. Beginning on 20th, the planes were finally dismantled and returned to the USSR. 21st. The next day, Kennedy formally ended the quarantine and lowered Strategic Command's defense condition from DEFCON 2 to DEFCON 4. At the conclusion of these events, National Security Advisor McGeorge Bundy was quoted as saying, "Having come so close to the edge, we must make it our business not to pass this way again." Looking back on the crisis, Robert McNamara claims the world was one step away from nuclear war. That step, he said, was the president ordering the invasion of Cuba. What the military didn't know then was that they had grossly underestimated Soviet and Cuban force strength. Military intelligence calculated 10,000 Soviet troops on the island, plus an additional 100,000 Cubans. We now know that the actual numbers were much higher. The Soviets had 43,000 combat-ready soldiers, and Castro had mobilized 270,000 Cubans to fight. Plans for the American invasion called for a first-day airstrike consisting of 1,080 sorties and an amphibious landing of 180,000 troops. Those troops would have been surprised by the strength of the resistance found on the island. Had Kennedy gone ahead with the invasion, casualties on both sides would have been very high. Furthermore, XCOM was also unaware of the tactical nuclear weapons stationed along Cuba's shore. Khrushchev had also given a standing order to his generals that if he couldn't be reached in the event of an invasion, they had the authority to launch the battlefield nuclear weapons. If Kennedy had invaded, the outnumbered Soviets would have used their nuclear weapons, and then Kennedy would have had no choice but to retaliate with American nuclear devices. The response would likely have been an attack on Soviet soil. 9 months after the crisis ended, Kennedy and Khrushchev signed an agreement to ban nuclear testing in the atmosphere. This marked the beginning of what seemed to be a new willingness to cooperate and communicate. However, on 22nd, 1963, President Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas, Texas. The Soviet Union backed down caused Khrushchev much embarrassment and loss of prestige. He was removed from power in 1964 by communist hardliners. one can't help but wonder, what would have happened if these two men had stayed in power? Perhaps the same two people who brought us so close to nuclear war, now changed by that experience, could have brought us far from it. Chapter 11, The Continuing Threat of War. Following the ousting of Khrushchev, another period of collective leadership ensued, consisting of Leonid Brezhnev as General Secretary, Alexei Kosygin as Premier, and Nikolai Podgorny as Chairman of the Presidium. This lasted until Brezhnev established himself in the early 1970s as the preeminent Soviet leader. In 1968, the Soviet Union and its Warsaw Pact allies invaded Czechoslovakia to halt the Prague Spring reforms. An agreement was signed in 1979 by U.S. President Jimmy Carter and Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev after the second round of strategic arms limitation talks, also known as SALT II, held from 1972 to 1979. It restricted the number of each side's strategic weapons, and its goal was to replace the interim agreement reached in SALT I. The U.S. Senate never ratified the treaty, partly in protest to the 1979 Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, but both countries observed its major limitations until 1986. Russia invades Afghanistan. In Christmas 1979, Russian paratroopers landed in Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan. From the West's point of view, it was another continuation of the Cold War, as was their actions in Berlin, Korea, Hungary, and Cuba. The Russians claimed that they had been invited in by the Amin communist government and that they were not invading the country. They claimed that their task was to support a legitimate government and that the opposing Mujahideen were no more than terrorists. Afghanistan was in the grip of a civil war. The Prime Minister, Hafizullah Amin, tried to sweep aside Muslim tradition within the nation, and he wanted a more Western slant to Afghanistan. This outraged the majority of those in Afghanistan, as a strong tradition of Muslim belief was common in the country. Thousands of Muslim leaders had been arrested, and many more had fled the capital and gone to the mountains to escape Amin's police. On December 27, 1979, Amin was shot by the Russians, and he was replaced by Babrak Karmal. His position as head of the Afghan government depended entirely on the fact that he needed Russian military support to keep him in power. Many Afghan soldiers had deserted to the Mujahideen, and the Karmal government needed 85,000 Russian soldiers to keep him in power. The Mujahideen proved to be a formidable opponent. They were equipped with old rifles, but had knowledge of the mountains around Kabul and the weather conditions that would be encountered there. The Russians resorted to using napalm, poisonous gas, and helicopter gunships against the Mujahideen. But they experienced exactly the same military scenario the Americans had done in Vietnam. By 1982, the Mujahideen controlled 75% of Afghanistan despite fighting the might of the world's second most powerful military power. Young conscript Russian soldiers were no match against men fueled by their religious belief. Though the Russian army had a reputation, the war in Afghanistan showed the world just how poor it was outside of military displays. The Cold War continues. America put a ban on the export of grain to Russia, ended the SALT talks taking place then, and boycotted the Olympic Games due to be held in Moscow in 1980. Other than that, America did nothing because they knew that Russia had got itself into their own Vietnam, and it also provided American intelligence with an opportunity to acquire any new Russian military hardware that they were using in Afghanistan. Brezhnev presided over a period of détente with the West, while at the same time building up Soviet military might. In October 1977, the Third Soviet Constitution was unanimously adopted. The prevailing mood of the Soviet leadership at the time of Brezhnev's death in 1982 was one of aversion to change. The long period of Brezhnev's rule had come to be dubbed one of standstill, with an aging and ossified top political leadership. Two developments dominated the decade that followed: the increasingly apparent crumbling of the Soviet Union's economic and political structures, and the patchwork attempts at reforms to reverse that process. Kenneth S. DeFays argued in Beyond Oil that the Reagan administration encouraged Saudi Arabia to lower the price of oil to the point where the Soviets could not make a profit selling their oil, so that the USSR's hard currency reserves became depleted. Brezhnev's next two successors, transitional figures with deep roots in his tradition, did not last long. Yuri Andropov was 68 years old, and Konstantin Chemenko, 72, when they assumed power, both died in less than 2 years. In an attempt to avoid a third short-lived leader, in 1985, the Soviets turned to the next generation and selected Mikhail Gorbachev. Mikhail Gorbachev took Russia out of the Afghanistan fiasco when he realized what many Russian leaders had been too scared to admit in public: that Russia could not win the war, and the cost of maintaining such a vast force in Afghanistan was crippling Russia's already weak economy. By the end of the 1980s, the Mujahideen was at war with itself in Afghanistan, with hardline Taliban fighters taking a stronger grip over the whole nation and imposing very strict Muslim law on the Afghanistan population. Gorbachev made significant changes in the economy and party leadership, called perestroika. His policy of glasnost was a policy that called for increased openness and transparency in government institutions, with freed public access to information. This was indeed a major change after the decades of heavy government censorship. President Reagan gave a speech at the Brandenburg Gate near the Berlin Wall on June 12, 1987, commemorating the 750th anniversary of Berlin. In the speech, he challenged Gorbachev to tear down this wall. In President Reagan's words,
"We welcome change and openness, for we believe that freedom and security go together, that the advance of human liberty can only strengthen the cause of world peace. There is one sign the Soviets can make that would be unmistakable, that would advance dramatically the cause of freedom and peace. General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall."
President Reagan, from his Brandenburg Gate speech near Berlin on June 12, 1987, he went on and stated that Gorbachev should do this as an emblem of Gorbachev's desire to increase freedom in the Eastern Bloc through his new policies of glasnost, or transparency, and perestroika, restructuring. Built in 1961, the Berlin Wall became known as a symbol of communist oppression. President Reagan's 1987 visit was his second within 5 years. It came at a time of heightened East-West tensions, caused in particular by the debate over the stationing of short-range American missiles in Europe and the United States' record peacetime defense buildup. Reagan was scheduled to attend the 1987 G7 summit meeting in Venice, Italy, and later made a brief stop in Berlin. The Brandenburg Gate site was chosen to highlight the president's conviction that Western democracy offered the best hope to open the Berlin Wall. His speech focused on a series of political initiatives to achieve this end. The famous "tear down this wall" phrase was intended as the logical conclusion of the president's proposals. As the speech was being drafted, inclusion of the words became a source of considerable controversy within the Reagan administration. Several senior staffers and aides advised against the phrase, saying anything that might cause further East-West tensions or potential embarrassment to Gorbachev, with whom President Reagan had built a good relationship, should be omitted. American officials in West Germany and presidential speechwriters thought otherwise. Reagan decided to leave it in. Former West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl said he would never forget standing near Reagan when he challenged Gorbachev to tear down the Berlin Wall. He was a stroke of luck for the world, especially for Europe, he said. 29 months later, on November 9, 1989, after increasing public unrest, East Germany finally opened the Berlin Wall. By the end of the year, official operations to dismantle the wall began. With the collapse of the communist governments of Eastern Europe and eventually the Soviet Union itself, the tearing down of the wall epitomized the collapse for history. In September 1990, Reagan, no longer president, returned to Berlin, where he personally took a few symbolic hammer swings at a remnant of the Berlin Wall. Gorbachev also moved to end the Cold War. In 1988, the Soviet Union abandoned its 9-year war in Afghanistan and began to withdraw its forces. In the late 1980s, he refused military support to the Soviet Union's former satellite states, resulting in the toppling of multiple communist regimes. With the tearing down of the Berlin Wall, and with East Germany and West Germany pursuing unification, the Iron Curtain came down. In the late 1980s, the constituent republics of the Soviet Union started legal moves towards potentially declaring sovereignty over their territories, citing Article 72 of the USSR Constitution, which stated that any constituent republic was free to secede. On April 7, 1990, a law was passed allowing a republic to secede if more than 2/3 of its residents voted for it in a referendum. Many held their first free elections in the Soviet era for their own national legislatures in 1990. Many of these legislatures proceeded to produce legislation contradicting the Union laws in what was known as the War of Laws. In 1989, the Russian SFSR, which was then the largest constituent republic, with about half of the population, convened a newly elected Congress of People's Deputies. Boris Yeltsin was elected its chairman. On June 12, 1990, the Congress declared Russia's sovereignty over its territory and proceeded to pass laws that attempted to supersede some of the USSR's laws. The period of legal uncertainty continued through 1991 as constituent republics slowly became de facto independent. A referendum for the preservation of the USSR was held on March 17, 1991, with the majority of the population voting for preservation of the Union in 9 out of the 15 republics. The referendum gave Gorbachev a minor boost. In the summer of 1991, the new Union Treaty, which would have turned the Soviet Union into a much looser union, was agreed upon by 8 republics. The signing of the treaty, however, was interrupted by the August coup, an attempted coup d'etat by hardliner members of the government and the KGB who sought to reverse Gorbachev's reforms and reassert the central government's control over the republics. After the coup collapsed, Yeltsin was seen as a hero for his decisive actions, while Gorbachev's power was effectively ended. The balance of power tipped significantly towards the republics. In August 1991, Latvia and Estonia immediately declared the restoration of their full independence following Lithuania's 1990 example, while the other 12 republics continued discussing new, increasingly looser models of the Union. The USSR is dissolved. On December 8, 1991, the presidents of Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus signed the Belovezhye Accords, which declared the Soviet Union dissolved and established the Commonwealth of Independent States, CIS, in its place. While doubts remained over the authority of the Accords to do this, on December 21, 1991, the representatives of all Soviet republics except Georgia signed the Alma-Ata Protocol, which confirmed the accords. On December 25, 1991, Gorbachev yielded to the inevitable and resigned as the president of the USSR, declaring the office extinct. He turned the powers that had been vested in the presidency over to Yeltsin, the president of Russia. The following day, the Supreme Soviet, the highest governmental body of the Soviet Union, dissolved itself. This is generally recognized as marking the official, final dissolution of the Soviet Union as a functioning state. The Soviet Army remained in place in the early months of 1992, but was thereafter absorbed into the different military forces of the newly independent states. Following the dissolution of the Soviet Union on December 26, 1991, Russia was internationally recognized as its legal successor on the international stage. To that end, Russia voluntarily accepted all Soviet foreign debt and claimed overseas Soviet properties as its own. Since then, the Russian Federation has assumed the Soviet Union's rights and obligations. The Communist Party maintained its dominance over the state largely through its control over the system of appointments. All senior government officials and most deputies of the Supreme Soviet were members of the CPSU. Of the party heads themselves, Stalin in 1941 to 1953 and Khrushchev 1958 to 1964 were premiers. Upon the forced retirement of Khrushchev, the party leader was prohibited from this kind of double membership, but the later general secretaries, for at least some part of their tenure, occupied the largely ceremonial position of chairman of the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet, the nominal head of state. The USSR was gone, but communism remained a threat. Now some final thoughts. Peace will never break out. Man is an evolved creature, and his evolvement and survival required him to be aggressive. There will always be wars. The military-industrial complex will keep military budgets high in the United States. This is most likely good. A strong military will always be required to counter potential enemies. The problem is that enemy capability will always become more capable. First, we fought with our fists. Then we fought with clubs, then swords, then bows and arrows, then guns, then tanks, airplanes, and other war machines. And the war machines keep getting more technical and sophisticated. In my aerospace career, I have been elated at some of our accomplishments. I have been appalled at some of our techniques and actions. But in my lifetime, we survived Hitler and Japan, and should I mention Italy. We survived Korea and Vietnam, but with perhaps less dignity. We survived the communism of the USSR, and so far we have survived the communism of Russia and China. Now we are fighting Islam extremists in Iraq and Afghanistan. We will soon fight such extremists in Iran and Pakistan. There will always be threats to our way of life and even to our lives. I'd rather live with some of the appalling actions of our military-industrial complex and get the most effective weapons than lose a future war. Reagan's Star Wars, written by Walter Parks. Your narrator is Rich Germain.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.